Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Host at 7 o'clock. Right now, we kick off the show with the strangest or weirdest laws we can find from around the world. Today's law comes to you courtesy of a place called West Virginia. Suppose there's a West Virginia in the United States. Suppose it would be the same one. You could be considered to be a lawbreaker in West Virginia if you happen to whistle underwater. The law is designed to prevent people from attracting fish whilst whistling, and that makes it the most unusual law, or one of the most unusual laws we could find. Personally, I happen to think if someone can whistle underwater without the use of additional instruments, they should be allowed to. That's a unique talent. But West Virginia seems to disagree, and so apparently do the fish. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we are taking a look at the Itala saga. We're going to be taking a look at the solvency debate that's been raging there. One party claims Itala Bank is solvent. The Prudential Authority, the other party, claims they are not. One party's filed court papers to evidence the insolvency. The other party, we don't know yet. We're going to be looking at that. We're going to be trying to unpack that with the founder and director of Karuska Consulting, Kaya Sotole, to see if we can wrap our heads around it and try and make sense of it. Then we've got our usual Warning Wednesday feature with the FSCA. We're going to be taking a look at some of the work the FSCA has done over the last year, some of the warnings that have been put out, some of the critical steps that have been taken to try and protect you as the public. And hopefully these steps are bearing fruit. Hopefully you are making better decisions, you're not falling for the same scams that were out there, and you're also doing a bit more for yourselves in terms of educating yourselves before you put your money with people that are promising you things they can't deliver. Then we're going to take a look at a conversation with Alan Gray around risk versus return, especially when looking at global balanced funds and other things in that line. We're in a space where people are looking for returns, but you're also looking to minimize the amount of risk you take to achieve these returns. And we're going to have this conversation with Alan Gray to see how they balance it and how potentially their insights can benefit you as an investor. Then we're going to wrap up the show with an executive lounge segment. We're going to be chatting to the CEO, former CEO of the Tsikululu Social Investments Organization, who is now the CEO of another organization that would be the Standard Bank Tutua Community Foundation. We're going to get a sense of what she does and what she does, more importantly, when she's not at work.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
We kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line, as we are on most Wednesdays, by Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro to take a look at what's been happening. Uncle David, good evening. Lovely to catch up as always. Gold price coming back down, platinum price holding steady. But all in all, it seems all of the rage is Asian equity markets, in particular Chinese equity markets. They had a really good day, and that spurred on our own industrial sector as well locally.
Yeah, a lot of people believe that that market is grossly undervalued now, and that we will see some kind of a comeback, particularly after, you know, the release of their new AI, DeepSeek. So more of that's going to happen. And Apple overnight, I think, announced a deal with Alibaba where they're going to bring AI onto the phone. So Jimmy, I think there are a number of investors who are now believing that China is at a low and it's time to get in. So on the other hand, there's still a lot of skeptics who are concerned about the nature of, you know, of China, authoritarian oversight and so on. But, you know, you can't deny that it's cheap. You know, it is. It's very cheap. And we've seen some big gains. But I think Alibaba's up over 30% this year. Mm. So,
Uncle David,
we waiting for the commodity market. You know, that's the worry on our side. But generally, Jimmy, we've done well. I mean, markets against the news, which we can talk about. Interest rates in the inflation in the U.S. kind of edging up, and that caused a little bit of a few ructions. But I think generally markets are very, very steady.
Mm. Uncle David, when we look at the China story, how much of the China story or the China undervaluation is now being fueled by the added element of volatility that is President Trump. We know his policies and his executive orders. I think he signed more executive orders than he's done anything else since taking office. And that has clearly had an effect on markets. I mean, the imports, the tariffs, all of that has created volatility in the markets. Are some market participants saying, you know what, China doesn't look so bad now?
I think we've got through all of this pretty easily. And I think what the market's saying is that Trump's bark is worse than his bite, and that he won't really follow through on a lot of these things. So we're still waiting to hear, you know, more about the 25% on steel and aluminium, how this works, who it works, which countries, and so on. So I think markets are just looking through all of this and carrying on, putting their heads down. You know, as results are coming down, we're coming to the end of the fourth quarterly reports, and they've been incredibly good numbers coming out of the U.S., and the markets are responding. You know, some very big gains, even in technology. So I think, you know, markets kind of looking ahead and basically ignoring what Trump is doing, believing that it might be short term and eventually it'll just work its way out.
You bring up the point around the CPI, and of course at the moment I believe Fed Chair Jerome Powell testified recently as well, about an hour or so ago, but you bring up the CPI number, and headline CPI doesn't look so bad in the US, ticking up ever so slightly, but core CPI seemingly year on year, that's a bit of a worry, from 3.1 or up to 3.3% now. We always knew the inflation picture was going to be sticky. We always knew it was never going to come down and not kind of have these sorts of movements. Is this enough to concern the central bank, or is it just a moderation of saying everything is relatively under control?
Exactly. You put it right. You know, that's what Trump, that's what Powell is saying. I think the belief is that this uptick is probably seasonal. It will adjust as we go on. And I watched the market. I got nervous when I saw the headline numbers coming through. I mean, the headlines coming through, you know, core and headline inflation. I got worried. Oh, no, here we go again. You know, another knock in the market. And yet the market's down slightly. The there's no major panic, no major sell-off in the U.S. market. Some of the top tech stocks are under a bit of pressure. Outside of that, there's some big gains. You know, there's some huge gains on in the U.S. market. So, yeah, you know, I think they said, okay, we better panic a little. You know, just that's what we do. But I mean, overall, the markets are, if I look now as I talk to you, the Nasdaq's only down 0.5%. The S&P down just over 0.5%, which is not dramatic given the headlines. Bonds did tick up. You know, we've seen the 10-year bond tick up about 10, 11 points, which is quite, you know, quite a major move. But broadly, I expected more of a reaction. So, and look at our market. You know, we were up today as well. We were down a little bit on the commodity side, but the industrial side, very, very strong. So, and you can see buying, you know, you can sense that money is going into the market. So I'm happy. I'm saying, okay, this is the worst news, fine.
Uncle David, do you think part of the market responses to things like inflation prints and all of that comes from a bit of exhaustion? We've gone through so much and markets have just been trying to price in so much that at this point, 10 basis points this way or that way, really just the market's like, you know what, it could have been worse, it wasn't worse, let's just move on kind of thing. Do you think a lot of it is
absolutely right,
having gone through so much?
Dead right. You know, I think we are exhausted, and I mean, you know, you were, even with Trump, you're exhausted already, 2 weeks in the job or however many is in 2-3 weeks, and every day is something else. You know, eventually say, listen, I can't process all of this, I can't digest it. Just let me focus on a few things. We look at the corporate results, some very good numbers coming out there. And the same thing on inflation, you know, to try and second guess decimal points becomes impossible. So you're right. I think the markets are, if you listen to Powell yesterday, I think he gave the message. The U.S. economy is very strong. The housing market strong, the labor market, you know, the housing market steady, labor market steady, U.S. economy in good shape. And I think that's the fundamental You know, that's giving the market the fundamental support. So these little movements either way, traders take advantage. But overall, you know, there's no need to panic.
Certainly sounds like we are going back to basics and going back to the things that we know, especially from a market perspective, to say these are the old things that are tried and tested. They haven't let us down in the past, and perhaps that could be a bit of a reset from a market perspective. When we look at the Rand, that also has kind of gone through quite a bit as well. There was initially quite a bit of volatility, but when we saw some of the proposed sanctions or measures from Trump, the Rand very quickly said, nope, we're going to hold our ground. We're not going to be stressed out by a temporary kind of situation. And you're seeing that still kind of play out. Granted, I suppose the Rand is waiting for our speech next week, which is going to be a very important
one. That's going to have no importance. You're not going to hear anything new. You know, it'll be a two-pager. So it won't. And the poor old newspapers, you know, they're all going to have to try and fill up pages and pages of nothing really to say. And I think already most of it's in the market. But you're right, you know, with all with the news that came out over the week, everybody thought that the Rand would go 19. Forget it, it's 18.50. The 10-year bond is, I don't know, somewhere around 10.5 with inflation 5. Still remains a very, very attractive area to go into. You know, it's and credit to Reserve Bank, credit to Treasury. They're keeping things very steady. So I'm with you. I don't think I think the Rand is showing quite a lot of strength at 18.50 now. It's going to follow the dollar, you know, and the dollar was stronger today. So all we need is some kind of burst, you know, against the dollar, a run in the market, some good inflation numbers coming through, and you know, we'll make big improvements. But for the meantime, I think things are very, very steady and you can sleep at night.
I, for one, enjoy sleeping peacefully at night. We're certainly going to catch up next week after that budget speech takes place, because I definitely want to get your thoughts around what has been said. But we'll leave the conversation there for now. Thanks as always, Uncle David. Lovely catching up with you. David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth on market movements, market sentiment, and the fact that we can all sleep at night for once.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Some investors prefer to build their own portfolios using a range of specialist funds. But for most investors, a holistically managed global balanced fund is a more effective way to manage risk and achieve real long-term returns. Tune in to the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Nick Curtin, Joint Head of Institutional Clients at Allan Gray, joins me to explore balanced funds and unpacking the long-term benefits of high-equity multi-asset portfolios over time. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're taking a look at an interesting update. We're looking at the Itala saga. This is the KZN bank, or the bank that had somewhat of a bank exemption license to operate at some point. We looked at the story last year, and we have a bit of an update from the Prudential Authority has submitted new court papers that challenge the solvency of Itala and that support its bid for having the bank liquidated. I'm joined on the line by the director and founder, by the founder and director at Karuska Consulting, Kaya Sotola, to take a look at this and see if we can get our heads around it. Good evening, Kaya. Lovely to catch up with you as always. You and I looked at Itala Bank last year, and we looked at the FSCA's suspension of their FSP license, but we also looked at the Prudential Authority's decision to have that exemption for a banking license revoked after 10 years. Now we've got new information around the solvency of the bank, and the papers that were submitted to the court suggest that Itala is some 500 million rand short on meeting its solvency requirements in terms of the amount of deposits it needs to return to its investors. What's the latest happening here?
So there's a lot happening, unfortunately, and part of that is stuck in the courts, which makes it very difficult to actually know what the true state of affairs is, because in the court papers, you basically feel like you're reading about two separate entities, because one person says all is good and the other person says that nothing is good. But at the crux of the problem is that obviously when the repayments administrator came in December 2023 after the exemption notice had expired, that person was then responsible for overseeing the activities of the entity. And part of that would have been a question of assessing whether the entity remains as solvent as it needs to be, and if not, what should then happen. But the problem here is that, again, there are two versions to every single aspect of the story. So the first part is that when the repayments administrator came in, it was on the back of an understanding that Itala would not take on new deposits. And in fact, the repayment administrator's job is to start a process of returning deposits that had already been collected. And that doesn't seem to have materialized in the way that the Reserve Bank or even the repayments administrator anticipated. And since then, according to the repayments administrator, things have gradually become worse in the sense that the solvency position has become ever more fragile. And his recommendation has been that this must then be put into liquidation. That's that version of the story. On the other hand, when you then read what Itala's explanation of a state of affairs is, they are simply looking at a repayments administrator who's gone rogue, who is adamant that absolutely everything must be jettisoned off without listening to reason and without engaging with the substantive issues. So until the courts deliberate on these two different versions, we're not really sure what the state of affairs is. But what is also quite different here is that this is not a normal case where the courts can take years to deliberate. This is a case that must be resolved with a sufficient speed in order for depositors to know whether they're ever going to receive their money, whether there's enough for their money to be paid back, and how those channels are going to be facilitated. So it is something that is quite urgent, but I'm not sure if we're going to get a resolution anytime soon.
Now, Kaya, some of the pertinent matters that were discussed and some of the things that we looked at was around the initial setup of Itala and the process that Itala had operated under for the last 10 years to say that the purpose of the exemption that was granted was to obtain a license thereafter. And you and I got into this in our previous chat around this to say that that exemption is not for you to just sit on and not do anything about. Yet this seems to be what Itala has done. Something else that's been put forward in the court papers is that Itala, amongst its irregularities or inappropriate activities, has granted loans or credit-like facilities to more than 267 people under the age of 18, effectively granting credit to minors. In basic financial terms, that doesn't seem like something that would be legal. Now, you and I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what's been put forward in the court papers.
Yeah, and it's quite difficult to actually know whether this is a matter of people misrepresenting or whether it's people perhaps receiving those loans on the back of some guarantee by an adult person. We simply do not know. But I think obviously the fact that it made its way onto the court papers where it says that 1% of the loan book indicated that 267 of the cash advance clients were younger than 18 years, that instinctively is a red flag, because you'd have to ask yourself the question, well, if you're advancing loans to those particular individuals, how exactly did they pass the most basic and the most elementary hurdles in the National Credit Act regarding the affordability? And of course, if they can squeeze into the system, well, then what becomes of those that are of age but simply don't have the means? Because if the 267 indicates that your processes around onboarding clients and lending to them is weak, you can imagine how chaotic that will be on a much wider population that has not been stratified in terms of age, but maybe stratified in terms of loan size. So it, again, raises red flags. That's what the repayments administrator says is picked up. Itala has to explain to us what happened.
In terms of red flags, Kaya, I want to get into one that would probably give you sleepless nights as a chartered accountant, and given your experience in this aspect, and that's the solvency side of it. There's the 500 million rand that the Prudential Authority is alleging would be a shortfall from the deposit side of it. There's a separate 970 odd million rand that the IDFC is now putting forward to say that if Itala is to be liquidated, they will be out of pocket by that amount of money, if not more. When we look at solvency from a basic level, how do we explain it in terms of just the common man's understanding and how it relates to the banks?
Well, the simplest explanation is that you should have sufficient assets to cover your liabilities. That's really how you prove that you're solvent. The problem with banks is that the profile of assets and the profile of liabilities are very different. So the bank's liabilities are the amounts that it has taken as deposits. So if you go and deposit your money into a bank, it becomes a liability for the bank because they owe you. What the bank then does is that it takes your deposit and then it lends it on to the next person so that person can buy a house. Now, clearly, that person to whom the money has been lent is going to take 20 years to pay that amount of money back. So the simple question is, if what happens when you come back tomorrow and you say you want to deposit back? So there should be a balance of those particular cash flows that enables the bank to say that, look, if those ones that have given us money come back and they want to withdraw their money, there should be enough liquid assets in order for us to honor those before we have to force the ones that we gave the money to essentially sell their houses so that we can get the money back. So that's how you're trying to get the balance between those two. And I think, obviously, when you then look at the balance sheet of a bank on an ongoing basis, the simple question is, do you have the right balance between the sum of assets and the sum of liabilities? Do you have the right stress testing to predict what the cash withdrawal patterns might be, for example, so that you do have enough cash? Because the greatest risk that banks face is that one person goes and tries to withdraw 100 rand and the bank says, yes, we owe you, but we don't have the money. Because the first thing that that person does is that they tell the next person. And then suddenly everybody wants their money and the bank doesn't have it. So that causes a run on the bank. So that's something that you must manage proactively. And when you look at what the repayments administrator says in the court papers, when they did that assessment, it says that, look, if we had to sort all of this out overnight, we think there's a gap of 570 million rand. And then another report that had been done by the CFO says the gap might be 970 million. So the point is that there shouldn't be any gap. The point here is that both calculations show that there's a significant gap. And the question is, who will fund the gap? That is unknown.
Now, given that Itala Bank is technically considered a state-owned company, they go by Itala SOC, that would then bring up the question around whether or not Itala could be bailed out by the government of South Africa. And we've got our budget speech coming up next week. I want to get your thoughts around the precarious position that this bank finds themselves in. So even if we do cover that shortfall, whatever that shortfall is, whether it's 500 million, whether it's 900 million, let's say we cover the shortfall, how do we then move forward with an entity that no longer has a lending license, that no longer has a banking license, in fact was never granted a banking license? What do you then do so that those that have their money sent back are not then just put into a new organization?
Well, part of the problem is what exactly you started with, this question of whether it's a state-owned company or not. The issue here is that the Banks Act is quite clear about who and who may not apply for a banking license. And entities that are owned by state, by provincial structures like Itala, quite simply are not allowed to do so. So Itala is owned by a provincial entity, and of course, it is that provincial entity that should then be expected to be the first, reference call for any payments that need to be done. If national government had to step in, it won't be out of an obligation. It would be out of an acknowledgement that, well, perhaps the way we've overseen this process over the past 20 years makes us equally complicit in the escalation of the crisis. So this is something that the IDFC and the KZN provincial government are responsible for. If National Treasury comes in, it's only on the acknowledgement that those two anchor shareholders are not in a position to do so. So that's part of the problem here, because had Itala been decoupled from that corporate structure many years ago, they would have been in a much better position to apply for a banking license. That simply never happened. And that's part of the crisis that you're seeing here. So the license in question left them at the mercy of the Prudential Authority. And that mercy expired in July 2022 when they were told that the exemption notice would not be renewed.
The saga continues. We'll keep an eye out on the developments around this case. It does affect more than 2 billion rand of investor deposits. So there is a vested interest to make sure that depositors get their monies back, or that we get this matter resolved in whatever amicable way we can. Thank you so much for those contributions, as always, Kaya. Kaya Sithole, founder and director at Kuriska Consulting, joining us to take a look at the latest developments in the Itala saga.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around, As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Warning Wednesday. We're calling it Warning Wednesday. We're calling it Wacky Wednesday. Whatever it is you want to call it, it's our consumer awareness feature that we do as many Wednesdays as we can to help get you better prepared for the financial world out there and for the scams that we've been picking up on so that you don't fall victim to these scams. We're joined, as we are usually for this particular segment, by the Divisional Head of Enforcement at the FSCA, Gerard van Deventer, to take a look at some of the warnings, take a look at some of the work they've been doing as the FSCA, and take a look at how you can keep your money safe. Good evening, lovely to catch up with you as always. It's been a long year. I mean, you and I started this particular conversation piece around last year, and over the last year we've done well over 50 warnings around various things, around various scams and things that we've picked up on, things that you've been investigating from your side as the FSCA. Clearly it's been a very busy year.
Unfortunately, yes, Jimmy, and good evening to everybody. It's unfortunately been a very busy day, busy year. I wish it wasn't, because I know behind every warning there's a lot of really terrible stories of people having lost their funds, and sometimes people who really cannot afford it. But you're absolutely right. If I look back at the year, I can see it's been very busy, and a lot of work went into all these Wednesdays that you and I spoke about.
When we look at some of the things we've spoken about, we've touched on so many different things around what consumers are up against and what consumers are facing, and things like the evolution of AI and how impersonation scams are coming about, and people using unauthorized methods and all of that. Would you say that these challenges are getting better or getting worse at this point? I mean, I would think that the introduction of AI just means that your work at the FSCA and the work that we're trying to do here becomes that much harder, because we can't really tell the difference between what's good and what's bad anymore.
You're absolutely right. It's interesting that you pose that question now. Just this morning we were listening to a Japanese team talking about AI and, you know, the developments in AI and how they approach it from a regulatory point of view. And of course, Jimmy, if you listen to the wonderful things that AI are doing, it's just great that we have that development in the world. Unfortunately, this is also opportunities that it creates. And I mean, I've been around for a long time, and if you told me that somebody could make any of us or anybody else say something that we've never said, I would have said that is pure science fiction. Unfortunately, it is not. The Japanese Market Authority just showed us an example this morning of their commissioner, the head of the commission, punting a scheme that of course he was unaware of. And you know, in South Africa, we had so many examples of that. Well-known people, semi-celebrities and so forth, even journalists, anchor persons, saying things and punting schemes that's simply not the truth. It is nearly, well, I would say it's undetectable. I won't be able to know that it's not the case. And it's all about the scams. And of course, it extends to other areas as well. You get these messages and it sounds like it's coming from your boss, or it sounds like it's coming from the financial officer, and it instructs you to do something. So it actually extends outside our world of financial services. But inside our world of financial services, you must have heard the expression many times that markets are driven on sentiment. So if there's a well-known person talking about this great new investment, people are going to follow that. And that is unbelievable where that has landed in terms of technical ability. So we cannot tell the public enough times not to listen to any of this and to deal directly with your financial advisor, and on the basis that you phoned him or her, a telephone number, etc. But of course, Jimmy, what is the golden rule at the end of all of this? It doesn't matter who's speaking. If that person is telling you something that's clearly unrealistic, then you don't even have to think about it any further. Then you know you're dealing with a scam.
When we look at the scams and we look at the things that have been put out there, I think one of the things that we perhaps might not have emphasized enough is how difficult it is to recover your losses from these scams. So we've often talked about not getting into them in the first place and not falling for the things. And if it's too good to be true, it is too good to be true. But I think perhaps we should also take a look at the consequence side of it is if you put your money into these scams, are you ever likely to recover your money? Are you ever likely to even see a fraction of your money? Because now it becomes a separate kind of legal matter. It gets very complicated once monies are frozen and all sorts of things around that. Let's perhaps look at that, the consequence side of it, and hopefully in doing so, people can get a better understanding of just how painful this can be.
Absolutely. So yeah, that is a good point. I think the first important point to make there, Jimmy, is the fact that especially with online trading and with these scams stretching across borders, you have to accept that the moment that you are scammed, that money moves extremely fast and they will get it out of the country very quickly. And if it's large amounts, they cut it up into many accounts and eventually it will disappear. And linking on to that, it is so unfortunate that there are jurisdictions in the world that do not have proper regulation, financial regulation, and that do not pay attention to what their own citizens do, and it's often corporate citizens. So we look at the world and we divide it into two. We look at the world and say, here are some countries and they have some serious financial regulation. And you can imagine that Europe and America and Canada and so forth, and they will not knowingly allow a scammer to operate from their base. But then you get other jurisdictions where there's actually nothing more than you can register a company in that jurisdiction. So you have to understand if a scammer is operating from one of those, I'm going to say, if you look at something like St. Vincent and the Grenadines, there's no regulation. So if the company is operating from there, they have nobody to answer to. And we have nobody to contact and say, help us with this investigation. It's different with well-regulated jurisdictions. There we have an international agreement. We can contact those countries and those financial regulators, and we assist each other with investigations. But I think the major point here, of course, is that money moves fast and it disappears fast.
It's dangerous out there, folks. Stay safe. Do your homework. Do your research. Don't give money to people you don't know. And people solicit money from you and you've never heard of them before. Keep your money safe. You'd rather have it with you than have it somewhere else. We'll leave the conversation there. Thanks so much, Gerard. That's Gerard van Deventer, who is the Divisional Executive for Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, for our Warning Wednesdays.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. From warnings, we move to investments and we move to how to maximize the balance or the relationship between your risks and your returns. I'm joined on the line by the joint head of institutional clients at Alan Gray, Nick Curtin, to take a look at this. Good evening, Nick. Lovely to speak to you. When we look at investments, and particularly when we look at building investments and kind of the balance that you have to strike, how do you start to even think about dealing with your investment from a risk and return perspective?
Yeah, I think the first point to make is that this stuff it's quite hard, and I think we've kind of recognize that. So any of us who've tried to do it on our own will know that. There's many different ways of trying to go about it, but in our view, the kind of first step is to find someone who's got a proven ability and has done it for a very long time, and you have confidence that they can keep doing it. It's a very complex relationship, this sort of risk and return moniker that we all use, and it's important that you use somebody who's got a kind of holistic ability to grasp these things and do it through different cycles.
Nick, when we look at some of the investment decisions that happen, as you said, sometimes we try to do it alone. We don't really get far with that. But there's also another way to do it. There's the way of exploring things like balanced funds, exploring portfolios where the construction of that portfolio or that fund in particular has already taken some of the risk out of it. Why would someone then kind of look at that and say, hang on, this might actually solve a lot of my problems and address my risk concerns?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of one size fits. So it's really complicated for the investor who sort of invests in the balanced fund. I think that's always been the kind of beauty of it. And then obviously the fund manager that you get money to does kind of all the hard work. So they're making the decisions around which asset classes, which geographies, which securities, and trying to work out how to best combine those to create a decent real return through time at an acceptable level of risk. So I think it's about, the way I think about it is just making sure that the right people are kind of making the right decisions and trying to keep that almost as uncomplicated as possible, because there's a lot of value to having those decisions sitting in place, because we can cross the entire portfolio and get a better picture of what fits with what and what doesn't.
Nick, I seem to be losing you here and there. What I'm going to do is I'm going to shoot you back to our producer for a sec. We're going to see if we can get you back on a better line, and we're going to continue the conversation. I definitely want to get your thoughts around some of the considerations that we need to put into this balance fund. But while we do that, while we try to get Nick on a better line, let me perhaps give you a bit of an idea of what we saw today. We obviously touched on how good the markets did today some of the big standout movers there. I mean, the likes of Boxer up almost 5% on today's gains. RCL Foods up 2.7%, almost 2.8%. The likes of Implats having a good day. They gave us a production update earlier this week that we spoke to, I think it was yesterday actually, we spoke to Chantal Marx about that. But they had a really good day responding to that as well. The likes of Mr. Price also up about 2%. Some of the other guys that didn't have such a good day, Exxaro down 6% on today's trade, 6.3% or so there. The likes of ArcelorMittal back below, or rather kind of seemingly still below that 1 rand a share level at 92 cents. And I think we've got Nick back on that better line. Nick, are you back with us?
I am. Hopefully it's a better line.
Yes, much better line there. You were saying before we kind of disrupted the conversation that there were some considerations from a balanced fund perspective that you might want to keep in mind as an investor, especially when looking for the right kind of fund to suit your needs. What are those considerations?
Yeah, I think the first and foremost one is obviously a track record. The kind of proof is in the pudding, so to speak. But just because someone's been doing something for a long time doesn't necessarily mean they're still good at it. So there's a couple of other things that I think go into that. And one is just understanding the various market cycles that the balanced fund manager has managed assets through. Obviously, another important one is the people that are actually doing the job. So is there demonstrated succession or sort of multiple generations that it's been proven across. Often some people are very good at it, but there might be one or two people and you don't know if it's going to continue into the future. And then the ability to withstand business cycles. So I think that's the other important one. It's a pretty brutal industry. When performance is poor, clients take money away. It can be tough. So the ability for the organization to have enough stability to kind of withstand those pressures and stay standing and keep delivering returns through time. It's quite a rare combination when you apply those various filters.
Nick, when we think about these balanced funds, a lot of them are used in things like your retirement annuities and other kind of retirement products. Does this mean then that we should be considering, especially now at tax year end, maximizing what we put into these sorts of funds, understanding that, of course, their risk is taken into account? As you said, the fund manager might have a lengthy history as well and all of that. Is this a good kind of thing to be having a conversation with your financial advisor or whoever manages your assets at the moment to say, these are where I want to make the most of my tax benefits from, or at least maximizing my contributions into those before the year end is up?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is that time here. Yeah. So obviously the more we put away now, the more we're going to have in future where we need it. The old saying of, spend less, save more, do that as much as you can. We do have very attractive tax incentives to make us contribute. So you've got 27.5% of tax income that you contribute to refund. There's a cap on that at 350,000 rand, but that doesn't affect that many people. And then, of course, there's tax-free investments where you have another annual allowance of 36,000 rand of tax income, subject to a lifetime cap of 500,000. That's a contribution you can make on an annual basis as well. So, especially following the two-part withdrawals last year, it would be a good time to start talking about and actually putting some money back into the system.
Mm. Nick, how do you think these balance funds are going to fare now in the increased volatility that we're seeing in the markets, in the world? I mean, geopolitics now look very different to what they did, say, 5, 10, even 15 years ago. But a lot of things have changed. We've got a lot of new rules coming out, new risks and new factors that fund managers have to deal with. How do you think balanced funds fare in this kind of environment?
Yeah, I think you're right. We're in the fancy term is an elevated risk environment. But we all forget to suddenly, we're dealing with the future, and the future is uncertain. It's almost impossible to know what's coming. And for fund managers, that's kind of always been the case. There's always been uncertainty. So that's our bread and butter. That's what you pay us for. And a balanced fund allows us sufficient flexibility, especially when we're managing, such a broad universe, and we can do it holistically to manage those risks appropriately at a portfolio level. So I think going forward, the kind of rewards are going to go to those who are probably better at managing risk as opposed to necessarily shooting for sort of outsized returns. And that's certainly how we're positioned and have been for the last year or two.
It's important to understand risk. It's important to understand how it affects your portfolio. And it's even more important to have the proper conversations when looking to build your funds and your investment objectives. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Nick. Thanks so much for those insights. We do apologize for that rather patchy line through to Nick. That was Nick Curtin, Joint Head of Institutional Clients at Allan Gray. The segment was brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Allan Gray, long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's once again time to chat to an executive in South Africa, potentially around the world, but a leading executive nonetheless, to get to know them a little bit better and get to know what it is that they enjoy doing outside of their executive responsibilities. That is why we have our Executive Lounge, and this week's Executive Lounge guest is a lady by the name of Tracy Henry. She's currently the new CEO of Standard Bank's Tutua Community Foundation. Prior to having been that CEO, I say previously, and it's only really 13 days ago, she had a different title. She was the CEO of the Tshikululu Social Investments Organization, focusing on social investments as well. So very lovely to have her on the show, and it's always a pleasure to get to know another executive in the country. Tracy, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did you get into the work that you do? Because as we go into this conversation, there's a very clear thread that I'm sure we'll discuss around what your passion is and what drives you to continue the work that you do. But how did you get into this?
Well, good evening, Jimmy, and to all of the listeners. And thanks for having me on the show this evening. So I'm a social worker by training. I did my undergrad and then my master's in social work. And I went straight from there into the Chamber of Mines for the Center for Human Development. And in that role, I did a lot of work with employees and their dependents and children, providing counseling and support around family issues, around work performance issues, etc. I was so young at that point, but I really enjoyed the work. I enjoyed working with people, and I could see that through the work that I was doing, I could make a difference by using the skills that I have. But I also realized over time that if I wanted to have a greater impact in terms of what I could contribute, I would have to shift the focus a little bit. And at that point, after doing the counseling for 4 years, I joined Anglo-American in what was then called the Anglo-American and De Beers Chairman's Fund. And that was where I really got my first deep grounding in what social investment is, a very deep understanding, albeit at a very young age, of the huge inequalities in the country and the triple burdens of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. And it was through this work and traveling across, you know, every province in the country, meeting with local leaders, with the most incredible leaders of non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, that my passion for the sector developed. And I realized that just the power that if money, funding, investments from corporates, it was particularly from corporates at that point, could be channeled effectively, could make a difference, a real difference in the lives of people. And so that's how my career started. To be honest, I didn't think that this would be my career. I was in 17 different schools growing up. And so I also got to see lots of different parts of the country. And it was only when I went to varsity that I really understood where my interests lie. And with, you know, the wonderful support that I got from Goldfields back then with a bursary, it just opened doors for me to see the world through a different lens. And working with the most incredible people over the years has really ensured that I remain focused on this career of wanting to support investors, support communities to really achieve their full potential.
Tracy, after nearly three decades, if not more, what would you say is the most rewarding thing about what you do now?
You know, there's many challenges, and it's how we deal with those challenges that is really rewarding. So when we look at where our country is right now, we look at the unemployment rate, particularly amongst youth, we look at primary health care, education issues, and just how complex our world is and the pace of change that is so fast, trying to solve for those problems and working with different partners to effect change is what really inspires me. It gets me really excited. And of course, the one thing that really excites me and that I get really energized by is working with the talent in our country. You know, I've had the incredible privilege whilst at Chikalulu and now at Standard Bank as well, to work with some really incredibly passionate, bright young individuals, and seeing that energy and people that are really committed to making a difference in the country, not sitting on the fence, not complaining, but saying, let's roll up our sleeves and what are we going to do about that? I find that really energizing.
Mm. Tracy, while you were at Chikalulu, before you left the organization, you received something quite unique that not many people get to experience in their life, and that was Lifetime Achiever status. How was that for you? How did that feel?
I'm very deeply grateful for it, and I was surprised, but I deeply appreciate the acknowledgement from my board and my colleagues. I think what's really important about it for me is what it means in a very practical sense, and that a scholarship program has been set up, which I will be able to be part of, to direct in terms of where the funding should go, what discipline. And so because education is such a critical focus area for me and also obviously for the country, I'm deeply gratified by that acknowledgement from my board, but also that there's a deep meaning attached to it. And how can one use this award to further opportunities for other people? And that's really, for me, it's very exciting.
Mm. Tracy, how do you recharge your batteries? How do you get back after a long day, after a long project? How do you get back to being the best version of Tracy when all of the things that you do have taken a bit of energy out of you?
Well, I think there's some days where you just, you know, when it's been a really super crazy day in many positive ways as well, where you just need to sit and be still. And I think being able to center oneself and just to be quiet and to switch off the phone and everything else that's going on around you is really important. But generally what I enjoy doing when I get home, I love music, any music. So I'll put the music on, I'll start cooking. And I really, that energizes me, just being able to do simple things in life, you know, whether it's the cooking and listening to the music. I've got two wonderful Yorkies, which keep me very busy as well. And my children are at varsity, and during the week, they come home on the weekends. So this is a special time for me in the evenings, just to have that downtime, to be able to just unwind, listen to the music, and cook a good meal. But also having people around you that energize and support you, you know, for me personally, that's very important. And I've got, you know, wonderful friends with very diverse interests, and we do lots of things together, whether it's, you know, doing art projects together, whether it's doing you know, going out to see a show or a movie. And it's important that for me as an individual, when I energize, that I can have those quiet moments just to pause and internalize the day and relax, but also to be around people that have very diverse interests that also energize me. I also do, I'm a amateur beekeeper, and, you know, watching my bees in my garden, in their hive, is quite a rewarding experience as well, because they get along and they do the most amazing things every day. And they work as a team. And it's always a reminder of me about the potential of when we work together as individuals, as opposed to just doing things on our own. And once a year, I harvest beautiful honey, which I share amongst my friends. And it's the simple things in life that keep me energized and engaged and motivated.
Tracy, what's your favorite thing to cook? You mentioned cooking quite a bit. What's your favorite thing to cook?
I love cooking chicken. my children say to me, like, Mom, enough chicken. But I love chicken. So, you know, I experiment with different ways of cooking chicken, whether it's as a stir fry, whether it's under the grill, and just adding lots of flavors and spices, you know, whatever I can find in my cupboard, or if I've got something that's growing in the garden, I'll add that in. But chicken, yeah, is definitely one of my favorites to cook. I also enjoy, but I don't do it that often, it does take a lot of time and patience, is to cook fresh pasta from scratch, so with your flour and your eggs. And it's a very cathartic process, actually, to add all of these ingredients, to mix it up, and to slowly create this beautiful pasta in different shapes and lengths and sizes, and to cook that and to enjoy that with the family as well.
A cook, a beekeeper, but most importantly, a difference maker, someone who puts all of her effort into making sure that everybody around her can live a little bit better through her experiences. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Tracy, thanks so much for the time and for sharing so much about your life with us. We wish you all the best in the new role, and we look forward to catching up at another time. We'll leave the conversation there. That's Tracy Henry, who is the new CEO of the Standard Bank Tutuwa Community Foundation, joining us for this week's Executive Lounge. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hurst is going to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sports team. From my side, good night.